Okay, well, thank you very much. So let me first say I'm an experimentalist, okay? So this talk will be a little bit from the experimental perspective, not a deep theoretical talk, which Krisha is probably giving sometime down the road, right? A little bit more deeper into theory. So when I prepared this, actually was a very, very difficult task because this is an extremely old subject. This is also a subject where the definition of this alone is difficult. In other words, what is turbulence? Are they turbulences? Are there different turbulence states? What is it? What is turbulence in general? And so I thought I'd just start initially just to introduce turbulence. There's a saying that, I don't know, I contemplate a lot whether I should say this, but I say it anyway. So somebody was once asked, probably some of you remember who that was, they asked him, what is turbulence? And he said, well, it's like pornography, you know when you see it. And it's actually really a little bit like that. So let me show you. So turbulence, when I talk about turbulence, I talk about turbulence that always includes fluids. So it's not turbulence of the stock market, it's not turbulence with the economy, it's not uprising in some states like Egypt, it's just good old fluid turbulence. So what that means is you take a fluid, you stir it. And when you stir a fluid, it goes turbulent. Actually, most of you, when you pour your milk in your coffee, you would be surprised about the turbulence level that you're producing in that coffee cup. It's actually quite large. When your spoon goes back and forth, that's a turbulence level that theorists have tried to achieve for, I would say they got about to that stage about probably 10 years ago or something like that. They finally were able to simulate in a periodic box the turbulence in a coffee cup, right? Now that's just homogeneous. Isotropic, no spoon, it's just stirred somehow magically on the modes, you know, of this turbulent flow. So it's a very, very different turbulence than the coffee cup. I think right now, if you go to anybody here and say, can you simulate what would happen to a little bit of my, you know, a little bit of milk that I pour in to the fat, where would it actually go in the turbulent flow? When you start stirring, I think nobody can actually answer that question if you stir hefty. Okay, so what that means also is that turbulence usually is considered, you consider statistics of your flow. The flow is random, the flow is heavily stirred, it's fluctuating all the time, and all the things we try to get out of our predictions is statistical measures. How probable is it to see something of a certain kind? How probable is to have a velocity fluctuations? What is the dispersion if I put in a little bit of milk here? How does the milk spread? In average, not in detail, but in average. You know, how fast does it actually get mixed? So these are the questions we like to ask ourselves. And so as soon as in nature, of course, it's prevalent anywhere. It's definitely there in the oceans, in the atmosphere, in your coffee cup, in your aquarium. In this room right now, there's a high level of turbulence, believe it or not. I mean, a huge turbulence. First of all, because of the fans, but then also each person sitting here is a heater, very localized. Each head heats like mad. And there's a large convective blimp over each of you competing with this air conditioning here and producing a very complicated turbulent flow.
Or over you.
Over me, definitely. I mean, I'm even moving to get out of it, right? So, but what happens is so turbulence is everywhere. Usually you don't see it, right? I mean, here in this room, you look, you don't see turbulence. You might feel it, you put your finger up and say, oh, there's a velocity fluctuation. But you don't see it. Well, when does turbulence really get important? Turbulence gets important when it becomes to mix something. Like in your coffee cup, you make turbulence to mix the coffee. Or you try to mix something to burn it. So if you spray some gasoline into your gasoline engine, you want to mix it before it explodes, because otherwise it doesn't burn very well. So you need turbulence actually to mix things up. And any time we see what I would call the beauty of turbulence, like on this picture you see the beauty of turbulence, it's from astrophysics, but nevertheless I think this features turbulence very well because it shows you scales and scales and scales. So you see big scales and you smaller scales, you zoom in and you can imagine that if you zoom in it just looks the same again. So there's this self-similarity in a turbulent flow. And one thing that I find just the most astounding and beautiful thing is clouds. Now you don't have many here, but most of us are not from here. So that means we have a lot of time in studying, especially these night, fluffy cumulus clouds, right? When you look at a cloud, What do you see? You see structure within structure within structure. Or you see the smoke billowing out of a smokestack. What do you see? Structure within structure within structure. And that's because of the turbulent flow. Otherwise, it would be just like the marine layers that we sometimes get here, which is just this boring fuck. But when you watch, actually, when you're sitting on your bike and you just stop and watch, you also see there the turbulence because there's strong fluctuations in density of droplets coming along. And as you also know, as soon as there's a little bit of wind, magically the fog disappears. Why would that be? Well, it's because of the turbulence. Because the turbulence causes these fog particles to hit each other, they get heavy and they fall out. Well, they just evaporate because of the mixing in of dry air. Okay, so what I was just trying to say is that there is turbulence all around us. It goes from astrophysics, from the universe, all the way to the coffee cup, and all the way to biology, where you, for example, ask yourself, if I have a, where's Boris? If you have a butterfly, and a butterfly wants to find its mate, well, the wind over the grass is turbulent, and somehow this butterfly has to be chemotactic in finding out where this mate might be sitting, on which leaf is it actually sitting. How can I find the pheromones in this turbulent flow, which has strong fluctuations? How can I actually find that? Or you go to the ocean, where you have copepods, you know, zooplankton, where you have little animals. Sometimes they're big, but they're basically little shrimp. Imagine them being little shrimp. And you ask yourself, well, the flow in the ocean is highly turbulent. How do you transport, what happens to these little particles, which are now considered as particles? They are light, they actually even swim. And so they ask yourself, what is the turbulence? What does it do to these particles? And people believe that because of the turbulence, these guys are more efficient in being swept into regions of higher concentration. And so it's easier for them to find a mate and multiply. So what that means is turbulence is important in biology, in physics. It's important in medicine when you think about your heart and arteries. There's a transition to turbulence. You know, it's important, of course, when you fly an airplane, where you have a transition, so you basically have an airplane wing. But let's just assume a ball. So you have a ball, and you blow air at the ball, and then what we can have is we can have a laminar flow, where this just, you know, the fluid is just flowing around the ball, and then we have a turbulent flow where, this is an old experiment by Crandall, he had a strong flow, he put a wire here, so he made a little raised edge, and then what you get is here, you get a very, very turbulent structure behind this flow, and the drag on this ball will be very, very different from the drag in a laminar flow. So here is the turbulence, this is the transition to turbulence, and here we just have a laminar flow, which in Germany has this beautiful word, geschichtete Strömung, which just means it's layers of turbulence, which I just discovered recently, by the way, because I was brought up English. So I'm German, but I hadn't realized that geschichtete Strömung is such a beautiful word. Now what you immediately also realize is, if you talk about another thing for biologists, very important, ocean surface, entrainment of air into the ocean, in the upper layer of the ocean. How do you get air down to lower layers? It's all coming in through waves, but then it has to be somehow transported downward. And one of the big things is Langmuir circulation, where you have, like, the wind blows over the sea. You've seen that when you fly with an airplane, when you see sometimes these floaters which grow up in a line like this, right? If you fly to Chicago, you see that often. At least I saw it when you come over the Great Lakes, and you just fly in, and then suddenly you see all these funny lines of foam which are lining up. Well, in reality, the flow underneath these things, so in reality, these are kind of convection walls that look like this. No, so let me draw this. So like this. And so there's up, down, up, down, and where this thing is flowing down, if this is the surface ocean, then here basically the floaters accumulate, and then you have another periodic, let me make this bigger. So you have this, 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 and so we have here up, down, up, down, and so when you look at, and this would be the ocean surface, and so this is the current underneath, and the wind is blowing this direction, and then what you find is that here the fluid is coming up, so what anything that's floating on the surface is accumulating right there, right? You see that right here. And so this is what makes these structures, but this flow is indeed fully turbulent. So if you zoom in into this large-scale structure and look at just a little volume, you realize that this is completely random and mixed and has all the features of the turbulence that I will talk about in a minute. Okay? Good. Now, Of course, since I talked about all these phenomena, you ask yourself, well, if it's so universal, where does it appear? Well, it appears in interstellar dust, it appears in plasmas, which are charged. It appears, of course, also just in water, which we call a simple fluid, because it's simple. It occurs in fluids that are compressible, right? If the fluid is much faster than of the order of the speed of sound, it's compressible, or fluids which are lower. Okay. So then it occurs even in superfluids. So if you take helium, you cool it down far enough, then finally you go into the superfluid phase. But for example, if I take a tank of helium and I rotate it, I suddenly find a lot of little vortices going through the system, which are quantized. And these vortices, when you stir the fluid now a little bit mechanically or by some heat source somewhere, then this mixes heavily. And the next 3-4 days, you'll learn a lot about the dynamics of these vortex lines in this superfluid phase. Now you can also have, let me go through my little list. So superfluid, you can take water. So I could make this list now, but I just read it to you. So you can have superfluids, you can have polymers, you can throw in a little bit of polymers. Well, why is that important? I will come to that in a second. You can have multi-phase flows, bubbles in water, or oil in water, like we know from the big oil break, right? I mean, from our big source of oil in the ocean. Any emulsion that you're flowing, I mean, it can be really complex fluids, and there's no end in sight. You can have metals, liquid metals, turbulent liquid metals, plasmas, and you, of course, have reactions. Any burner that you have typically is turbulent as soon as you get away. So what that means is the variety of turbulent flows is almost indefinite. I mean, you can count them, and the physics you can put in them is endless. You can put in phase transitions, you can put in reactions, you can put in particles. You can actually ask yourself, if I have, for example, here my little shrimp, right? And there is a big vortex blowing this way. What is that shrimp going to do in this flow? If it's denser than the liquid, it's going to fly out of the corner, right? It's going to be swiped out. So if I have another vortex like this, and there's another little shrimp up here, you know, then these two guys might actually push together just because they have inertia, because they're heavier than the liquid, and that causes preferential concentration. So as you realize, the variety of possibilities is immense. And so what I will limit myself now is to incompressible, first, the incompressible fluids, which means I have no compressibility. My fluid is simple, which means that the it's water or gas, or an ideal gas, doesn't matter, but it's a gas. It's incompressible, it means I'm far away from the speed of sound. I have an incompressible fluid, and what I want to do is I want to just study that turbulence. And what we know about the normal fluid is that this normal fluid is moves and flows, but we also know that when it flows, it makes instabilities and produces some very disordered flow. And what we also know is that if I take a container of water and I stir it long enough, it gets warm, which means that the fluid motion through friction, through viscosity, goes all into heat. So at the end, in my fluid, what I end up with, actually this is an important thing for our experiments, because what we do is we have a container of water, which we stir with about 2 kilowatts, and all these 2 kilowatts go to heat, to nothing else. So if you don't do anything, your water boils after a while. So you really have to cool your experiment. So when 2 kilowatts come in, you have to take 2 kilowatts out, because otherwise you're just boiling your water and you do a completely different experiment. Which, for example, we have a large wind tunnel which uses 200 kilowatts. Well, we have to take these 200 kilowatts out of the system because it all goes to heat. Right? And so we have to do that. So let me just show you a generic flow which people have investigated for, well, almost 100 years, not quite, almost. There's one this afternoon which we hear more about, which is pipe flow, but I just want to look at simpler flows than pipe flow. I will explain why. So what you can have is you can make a grid. So what you do is you take a fence, you put a fence into the wind, and you study the flow behind the fence, right? So you make a grid like this, you blow laminar air through it, and you ask yourself what is behind it. So you have this this grid here, the air comes from here, or the water. And then what you get is you get basically the same thing that you get here. You get these vortices, these von Karman vortices. And then these mix up until over here, you get a, I don't know how to draw, you get a very disordered region, which is actually very self-similar. It's what we call homogeneous, statistically homogeneous, so it doesn't matter where you look. You take different volumes, you get always the same answer. You can also, it's isotropic, which means there's no direction is preferred over any other direction. So this is a beautiful realization of a flow, and actually probably the best realization of an isotropic homogeneous turbulent, statistically homogeneous isotropic flow. There is, this has been investigated for a long time, and when you look, for example, at the size of these vortices, what you realize is two things. You realize it starts off with tiny little vortices coming off these rocks, and then finally you come in a region where the flow has larger structures but is self-similar. So there's an instability region. So what that means in a typical wind tunnel, you have, if this is the mesh distance m, you have to go about 16 m or 20 m or even 30 m behind to finally discover where the turbulence is fully developed. In other words, where we would expect some kind of universality into the flow. If I do it up here, I will still see the signature of the generation mechanisms of turbulence.
What's going through the wind tunnel? Is it air?
Air, water.
And what sets the 16, the 20, the 30? I guess the viscosity or something like this.
What sets that distance? Mm-hmm. Actually, just the mechanism of the shedding of vortices of the ruts. It's universal. It doesn't matter what viscosity you put in there. I mean, it depends on the Reynolds number, of course, what we end up here with. How strong this is fluctuating depends on the viscosity. But you have to go about 16, 20, 30, probably 30. If you want to play it safe, you go 30 behind the wind tunnel, 30 distances. And then this flow has mixed enough, you know, the instabilities, the vortices have mixed with vortices enough to finally generate some kind of universal state that everybody finds in every experiment, and which has these nice properties that I just talked about.
How do you measure the vortices and how do you see them?
How do you measure this? I had planned to say this later, but I can say something about it. The traditional way of measuring is you take air, so you actually take, or gas, let's call it gas, right? So you take a gas. Well, one way of just seeing it, you put in flakes, for example, in the water flow, and you just see the vortices by the alignment of the flakes. That's not a good measurement, that's more optical. You can do this at home with your shampoo, with your favorite shampoo. Just take your favorite metallic shampoo, pour it into some water, then you get this beautiful fluid, and you can just take a comb, push it through, and you will see the generation of vortices behind your comb. This is very similar to this experiment. But here what you do is you take a gas, and what people typically do, they take hot wires. So they take a little wire, which they heat, which is typically 2 microns in thickness, and about the smallest we can do, I think, is about 20, 30 microns long, 40 microns long. That actually limits us a lot. And then what you do is you keep that wire at a constant temperature. And depending on the wind speed, you have to put in more or less power, and that then tells you what the wind speed is. These kind of sensors are pretty much in every car. So if ever your car breaks, it might be worthwhile just to opening the thing, drop a little bit of acetone on the little wire, and you might be fine. You might not have to buy actually the new part, because there might just be a little bit of dust on it. So my Volkswagen Beetle had one, because I took it apart and looked. So I assume that the other cars have the same thing. So these hot wires are used very universally.
This isotropy, does this include the direction of the flow?
Well, actually what it is, it's decaying. So in reality, when you plot the length squared of your typical vortex size versus the distance downstream, okay, then what you find is that there is some kind of starting region, and then you get a linear relationship, which starts at about 16 m. This is x over m, so about 16. Is where you start to get in a, so it's actually decaying. It's because there's no new energy being fed into the flow. So it's slowly changing, that's true.
So now what I forgot to say. Is sort of transported towards the walls, or? the momentum of the.
Well, it's the momentum. Well, you have a mean flow, right? So you get 5 meters per second. And of course, all this, what happens is you get vortices, and in these vortices, you get very strong velocity gradients between vortices, and these velocity gradients that put the energy to heat.
I guess the question is it isotropic in the laboratory frame or in the frame of the flow, the comorbid
frame? Probably more in the laboratory frame, actually, because what you do is, I forgot to say, you immediately would have asked me, well, what do you do, right? You get a time signal now, right? You don't really get the spatial properties of a turbulent flow, you get a time signal. And so there's something called Taylor's frozen flow hypothesis, which says that if I measure at a given spot, but the fluctuations are much smaller than the mean flow, then I can take, just put the mean flow in the equation, eliminate time, and get space. Now that has a great advantage because your time traces are almost infinitely long. Right? Now if I make an experiment like your favorite coffee cup, right? Well, first of all, hot wire is out. Doesn't work, it's water. Hot film, doesn't work quite well. You can make a little film that you can heat, then you're sitting on the boundary, you're not sitting in the flow. There's no mean flow. There's no mean flow. Which means if I poke in this flow a wire, you know, something like this, with a little wire, then, of course, this perturbs behind the wire, right? So I cannot do that here, because anything I do in there perturbs the flow. So I have to go to some kind of different passive measurement, and I can do it right now. The method to use here are two techniques for measurement. One technique for measurement is you do what's called PIV, which probably some of the biologists have used. So what you do is you say you throw a few, you image a part of the fluid, let's say you put a light sheet. So if this is your fluid, you know, let me see what I can draw this. Right, so this is, right, this is my fluid. What I do is I put a light sheet across, so I have now this light sheet, right? If I have particles flowing into this light sheet, they glow, and if they're not on light sheet, they're dark, I can't see them. Now what I can do is I can take a camera picture of the particles at any given time. And then what I do is I make a cross-correlation between images. And by cross-correlating the images in little regions, I can look at the optical flow. Basically, I can look, you know, as if I have a picture like this, you know, the particles are like this, and then a little later they are here and here and here, then if I do this for each individual particle, I could get the velocity, but that's not what PIV does. PIV uses lots of particles, so you don't resolve every particle. So what you actually resolve is just that it gets a little brighter here, a little darker there, and by doing that, you can take a cross-correlation technique, and that tells you how much a certain structure in the flow has moved to somewhere else. This is used in, traction microscopy, when you have this gel, and you have the cells crawl on the gel, and you see how the gel deforms, then this is exactly the technique they're using.
So while we're talking about measurements, how do the hot wires obviously are measuring V squared, not how do you get the direction?
Oh, because of the wire. Because you make an X wire, you make certain combinations of wires. What is the Tsinova probe? How many wires does it have? Does somebody remember?
Nine. You said nine? You do this configuration of nine wires. And then you cross-correlate them, and then you know which direction it flows by.
Right, right. Yeah. So the one breakthrough in my little review that I've just written in Göttingen was they used three wires arranged in a row. So what they did is they had a wire like this, a wire like that, and a wire like that, all parallel going down. I just talked to the people in Göttingen to find out whether I got it wrong, and I had it wrong. I thought they used the crosswire, but they didn't. They actually used this arrangement. And so the wind comes now from an angle, then this thing is shedding. This wire is already starting to shed, and you can calibrate this thing to actually get the direction this way, because you have this vortex shedding from the first wire. So there's clever techniques, but it's you have to use multiple wires. Otherwise, you just get the power. So
spatial resolution one gets with PIV.
Well, PIV, the particles, depends on the particles you put in, right? The limits are, so this is 2D, so this is a traditional PIV, right? The issue is about the dynamic range. So, you know, what can you actually resolve? You get a picture, typically you need so much light then you can take a picture of perhaps 10 pictures per second, double pictures. So what you do is you take a picture, another picture, then you wait, another picture, you wait, and you get roughly about 10 hertz out of that. Now it's getting faster. Now what they have just started doing is they do this now in 3D. So what they do is they take three cameras, they illuminate a volume, and they then do a cross correlation in 3D, which is called tomo-PID, tomographic PID. Or in reality, it's just a stereoscopic imaging and cross correlation technique, which so far is computationally extremely expensive. Really, I mean, it's because you take these full 3D images, you need cameras here with very high spatial resolution, like 4,000, you have 4 megapixels, 8 megapixels, to really figure out what the flow is doing. Now, another technique is to take the particles for what they are and actually follow the particles through the flow themselves. This is what I do, mostly. So what we do is we do stereoscopic imaging, fully time resolved, of a few particles while they zip through the flow. So if you think so, you have an aquarium, in the aquarium are the Kobe pots, you have some aquarium pumps which correspond, produce some turbulence, and you just want to know where do the Kobe dots go as a function of time, and you want to do that with such a high time resolution that you can even measure the acceleration of a Kobe pot. And this is what we do. Now I will get to the scales in a moment. Okay, good. So another example which we hear about this afternoon is pipe flow. Now in pipe flow, what you have is you have a flat plate flow, or you have a channel flow, which is open on the surface, and you get a velocity profile like this. And so this is the mean flow, and so this is the mean flow. This is, let's say, u going down the pipe, and so the velocity here is high. Here the velocity has to be zero because of the boundaries, and what you get is you get an instability at the boundaries, where basically turbulence is being shed off of the boundaries. And now we know that this flow is what's called linearly stable, which means that it should actually never go unstable, but it actually does. It does so by turbulent bursts, where you have the pipe, and suddenly in the middle of the pipe there's a burst of turbulence, and then it just travels downstream. And Björn Hoff, who's going to be here, and his collaborators have shown that this is actually a transient state. So it comes, and if the system would be infinitely long, it would die out. But there is no pipe that's long enough to actually show that. And now if I drive it stronger and stronger and stronger, so in other words, I increase the velocity, then finally the whole pipe will be turbulent. And then what I will find is exactly the same statistical signature that I find in here. And one thing that Björn Hoff will talk about, and we have a section on boundary layers, so this is a boundary layer because this is where the instability happens, in that he was just successful in controlling this turbulent state. So in other words, he was able to avoid turbulence. So this has nothing to do with turbulence anymore, because if there is none, you've just avoided it, and so you don't have to worry about it. Why is that important? Well, because the friction in the pipe is much higher with a turbulent flow than it is without a turbulent flow, because you lose a lot of energy into the turbulence. And these huge gas pipelines, which in Europe would be from Russia to Germany or Europe, Western Europe, in the US it's from Santa Barbara going to the East Coast, huge energy costs in transport of gas through these pipes. And so if we solve this, we have done probably a huge contribution to the global warming problem, because we can avoid a lot of energy costs in the pipe. In oil, it's different, because in oil they found clever ways of using polymers to reduce this instability a lot. Okay, so let me now do a little bit of... Just ask me if you have questions while I'm doing this. No questions?
So what parameters do those instabilities depend upon?
Well, in this case, it would depend on... I will get to the Reynolds... It depends on the Reynolds number, and I will introduce that in the next moment. It's basically the velocity, the mean velocity, the size of your container, the typical size, and the viscosity. And these are the two competing effects, and that produces the instabilities. And of course, the nonlinearities in your equation. So what I said is I want to study the most simple thing. So that means it's incompressible, which means that great divergence of my velocity field is equal to zero. And then we can write down the Navier-Stokes equation, which I write u rho times A is minus gradient P plus eta Laplace E plus some external forces. And so what you see in this equation is, well, this is just MA is the sum of all forces, is the momentum transport equation. And so what you see here is this is the gradient of the pressure. There's this very non-local quantity, the pressure. If you do something on this side, the system will know everywhere that something happened. Pressure gradients drive the flow. As soon as you break at a pressure gradient, you get an acceleration in the fluid. And then we have this kind of diffusive term where basically momentum is being diffusing away through viscosity. And so this is the normal viscosity. And of course, it makes sense to divide by rho. And it says here 1 over rho, and it's here over rho, this thing over rho, and this thing is then the kinematic viscosity mu. And so what that means is that, for example, for a gas, the kinematic viscosity mu is much, much smaller,
larger. It's more viscous than water.
It's much, much larger, exactly, than it is for water, because the density is much, much less. Right.
The Navier-Stokes equations are an approximation to momentum.
Yes.
In which you neglect quadratic pieces.
Yes.
Everything's linear. Everything's
yes.
Right? But turbulence just looks like the thing where higher order terms of radiance and velocity would be important. Just through a naive process.
Yes, yes. Has anybody calculated anything on that? I mean, so far we are pretty safe using it.
Because it's really, one needs to go to supersonic flow to get your viscous scale of order of mean free pass. So one can show that the ratio of mean free pass to viscous scale is the ratio of velocity to velocity of sound.
Okay, so it's okay as long as you're below the velocity of sound.
Of sound, right. And incompressible, we are far away anyway.
Incomparable is okay. But
right, so the mean free path of the gas doesn't play a role.
And none of your experiments are supersonic.
None of the experiments of, other than I think the astrophysicists that are going to come, will be compressible or supersonic.
Well, I just meant you, not the whole world.
Pardon me?
I didn't mean the whole program.
No, I was just saying my experiments are all in regards to the fluid incompressible. Once you put particles in, the story is different because the particles themselves are compressible.
Unless but you get a leak, I guess.
Get a leak, then it's yes, then but then I'm worrying about other things. I'm not measuring anything anymore. Okay. So what you can define is what you see is when you make this equation dimensionless. What you find is the Reynolds number, and the Reynolds number is just the velocity times the typical length scale over the kinematic viscosity. And if this number is large and this number appears in the equation here, it's 1 over Reynolds. So this means if Reynolds is large, then this term is very small, relatively small. And so then everything is basically driven by this and that. But if then Reynolds would be of order 1, then this term, the dissipation term, will become very, very important. Right? And so this is just V L over nu. And so I have, so far, by the way, please notice, I've not talked about turbulence. I've just said I have a typical velocity, I have a typical length scale, and I have a typical kinematic viscosity. So if I want to talk about turbulence, I should replace this with a fluctuating velocity. So basically the RMS, so which would be, I call it U is V RMS. And the length scale has to be something that comes out of the turbulent flow itself. Because I shouldn't just use some dimension of my experiment. That's a dangerous thing to do because I can't use that, right? So what I have to come up with is a way of measuring this. And so what people did is, and people still do, and that's where the name integral scale comes from. This is the integral scale of turbulence, well, because it's an integral. And so what you do is you write down the correlation function. So if this is the fluctuating velocity u, then what I write down, I just write down g of r is equals u of x times u of x plus r. And then I have to do the average over this and divide it by u squared. And then that this is the, and this is an average over x. And so I think I did this right. And so what that means is this is my correlation function of this quantity that I'm looking at. Let's say one component of the velocity. And so what I find then is when I plot this thing, it looks something like that, depending there are details, but we don't worry about them right now. What you find is it starts like this, and it just falls up as a function of r. So this is g of r as a function of r. And what you can do is now you can say, well, how do I get a length scale out of this? Well, you just integrate this thing over r, and that gives you a length scale, right? So what you do is you say the integral length scale L is integral from 0 to infinity of g of r dr. And one thing I want to get out of this workshop is, why is that a good quantity?
Times r.
No, this is fine. I didn't normalize it. And this is dimensionless, so it's okay.
What if it's a good quantity?
Pardon me?
You said get out.
Well, you see what happens is, as soon as in the wind tunnel, I can always integrate to infinity because the wind comes by infinitely long. So the integral is actually pretty well defined. But if I go to any finite size experiment, I have a problem. I cannot integrate to infinity. I can only integrate to the system size at best. And typically, when I have an experiment with a finite size, my homogeneous isotropic turbulence is right in the... So let's assume the experiment that I do a lot, which is, let's put it over here, which is the French washing machine, okay? What it is, it's basically a propeller and another propeller over here, and these counter-rotate. And there's a flow that looks like this, a large-scale flow that looks like this, okay? And if I measure my turbulence, clearly this is anisotropic and inhomogeneous because the velocity in the middle is exactly zero statistically if I average forever. But if I move up a little bit, I immediately pick up a mean flow, right? So what we do is we just subtract the mean flow, we call it, you know, and then it turns out the turbulence actually is quite nice, as all our papers show. And we somehow, by some reason, can compare it to all these calculations for homogeneous isotropic turbulence. And what we do is we take, at best, so this thing is, let's say, 60 centimeters. And at best, we have a volume of about 5 centimeters in which our turbulence is well behaved. So what that means is I can only measure in here, but I have to integrate infinity. So clearly, that definition does not work for this experiment.
This probably asymptotically is this asymptotically exponential? This g of r.
Well, this is where you start discussing, because that's what you can do, and then people come and say, well, you shouldn't do that. And that's actually what everybody does. They just approximate some asymptotic law and then calculate it and get a number. So it's a purely experimental procedure. What if it turns out if you take this quantity and you take it for what it is and you put in here some length scale, I don't know, l hat. And you make it finite, and then it turns out you can interchange the sequence of integration. So you first can do the integration over L hat, and then do your averaging. And then if you do that, it's exactly zero, because it's a finite system, so you can interchange the way you integrate. For an infinite system, you're not allowed to do that, but for a finite system, you are. So strongly mathematically seen, this function should actually look like this. And then when you do the integral, it comes out to zero, so this length scale is not even defined for any finite system. This is something Combe-Bello-Corson pointed out in the 60s, and which makes it difficult, because there's other ways of getting around this problem. You can measure the dissipation.
You want the length scale in order to find the Reynolds number.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. But you can get around that. This is what people typically do. Now, for the community, if any of you ever come to any of our talks, we use the Taylor microscale, Reynolds number. And Taylor, for the lack of a better length scale, defined that the parabolic approximation to this curve up here gives him a length scale, and he called that lambda. And that's the Taylor scale. And there's methods of measuring this Taylor scale. And so what that means is we also have a Taylor scale Reynolds number, Re lambda, which is V times lambda over nu. Okay, and Taylor has shown that for isotropic and homogeneous turbulence, you can write a relationship between these two, which is R lambda, R e lambda, is equals square root of 15 times R e. Okay, so what that means is our numbers that we give in all our conference are small. 10,000 is a gigantic number because we took the square root of it. Okay, so instead of writing down millions, we actually write down tens of thousands in the talk.
If I understand correctly, the theory you're comparing with starts from the measure of Stokes equations and produces g of r somehow, and then you remeasure g of r.
I don't think that has been numerically, yes,
right,
but...
Let me not show you. What is it to do with your measurements?
Well, what do you measure instead of this? You measure the structure functions. So you measure velocity differences instead of measuring products, and then you get around this problem of going to infinity.
But the theory predicts something about...
Well, the structure, out of scaling arguments, you can derive how the structure functions look like, the different order structure functions of the different moments of the velocity differences. And this is what Kolmogorov did in 41, and which has been refined ever since with multi-fractal models and things, but none of them are, as far as I can be corrected, but none of them have been derived from Navier-Stokes.
Except the third order.
Pardon me?
Except the third order structure.
Except the third order structure function, which is exact. But otherwise, nothing has been derived from first principles. There is relationships, there are relationships between the different, there is the Karman-Howard equation, of course, which is
also
the other equation.
Actually, recently derived something about Kipps order, which is still have not been measured, but basically it's a third moment.
It's a third moment, right?
Basically some scaling hypotheses that you're...
Yes. Well, the third moment you can derive.
Exact derivation.
The third moment you can...
It's just conservation.
Because it's flux.
Fluctuation dissipation.
You can just really calculate it completely. Now, can you do that for... Is that also valid for anisotropic turbulence?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, good. Good. Thank you. Learned something. Okay.
So, naively, this second definition sounds a bit dangerous because the attempt of defining an infrared length or large distance cutoff that mixes it with this small distance behavior, is that an issue? Or?
No, I mean, for me, I mean, all the years that I see, I look at it look completely idiotic. And the fact that experimentalist, I mean, this is really lambda, I never understood. It just mixes large scale and small scale in some kind of measure, which makes some theoretical assumption for its definition.
Right. So lambda,
millions, so
I mean, this one is well defined. I mean, this lambda here is...
Reynolds number, where does it enter except to say it's true?
Pardon me?
Where does it enter into comparing? So this is to compare different systems, if you want.
No, Reynolds number, yes. So the main, I think so, because the level we know for a fact that the higher the Reynolds number is, the more universal the flows become, the more the anisotropy of the driving that you have at the large scale disappears. So the higher the Reynolds number.
You actually have theory of corrections, which go like one.
There are predictions of how there's corrections, like the acceleration variance, for example. There's predictions from multifractal analysis. There's predictions of how it depends on the Reynolds number, and that's one of the important questions. What's the limit? What happens at r lambda going to infinity? Is that even a good limit? Now, experimentally, as I will show you in a sec, I can do this even right now. Well, let me do first two length scales, and then I get to it. So the question is now, if I have this length scale, so what I'm talking right now is that I'm talking about the large scales, and I'm talking about, I have about 10 minutes, is that right?
No.
Okay, so I talk about the large scales so far, right? So I'm talking about the fluctuating velocity, which is a large scale quantity, and I'm talking about the large scales. So we need somehow something that gets the energy out of our system, right? And so what we need to do is we have to come up with an energy dissipation. And a very simple way of looking at this is you say, if I look at the fluctuations, the power of, let's say, one of these U, that has the large scale, U and L, well, what is the power per unit mass that goes through the system? And I can just write this as U squared times U over L, right? U squared is just the kinetic energy, and U over L is my typical time scale. And then what I get is I get that my power here is then U cubed over L, okay? So this is one quantity that I can write down. Now, if I assume that in my turbulent flow where I generate the turbulence, so if I assume that there is an energy cascade, so what that means is I'm producing the turbulence at the large scales, and then it falls through some kind of vortex breakup, or who knows what statistical process, it goes to smaller and smaller and smaller scales. And I had shown you in my Navier-Stokes equation, this term here goes like 1 over Reynolds number. So clearly when Reynolds number is equals 1, the dissipation has to set in. So when if I imagine, Prandtl calls it a bale of turbulence, other people call them eddies. We don't really know what they are, at least I don't know what they are, but they're just objects of different sizes, and these different sizes give the energy, and the cascade process down to smaller and smaller scales, and at the smallest scale you get dissipation. And let's just assume there's just one dissipation process. There's not lots of them, there's just at one stage suddenly it happens, boom. Okay? And so what I can do is I can say that the dissipation, so this is our, let's call this epsilon, is the energy transported through this cascade. So this means that at every step, this at the smallest step, which I call U eta over eta, the energy is now down, went down all the way through my cascade, and it equals dot, 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 all the way down to the smallest eddy. Okay, which has size eta, which is the Kolmogorov length scale, and has velocity scale u eta, the Kolmogorov velocity. And now what that means is now we're done, right? What you already see is we have u cubed over L, we have u eta squared over eta, now we have to somehow introduce viscosity, and what we know is that the dissipation goes like, you know, this would be now dissipation, goes like mu times basically the gradient of the velocity, so something like this, u by dx squared. Well, if I make some kind of dimensional analysis, I'm allowed to write here u over eta squared. Okay, and now what you see immediately is now we have, you assume that this is a cascade process, so which means you set these two equal. We call them just epsilon or dissipation, which is the power per unit mass. I just set these two equal, I eliminate u eta, and I get a length scale. And this length scale is the Kolmogorov length scale. And so you can do this, it's not very hard. You can come in different ways. You can also say, let's define the Reynolds number 1, right? And you just go down, when is my Reynolds number 1? Because that's exactly the scale. And so what you find out is that you get two length scale, you get eta. Eta is equal to mu over 3/4 divided times epsilon to the minus 1/4. And we have tau eta, which is the time scale that belongs to that smallest scale, is just square root of mu over epsilon. So what you see is that if you think about the difference between L and eta, and the big time scale, which is just the velocity, the length scale divided by capital U, by our fluctuating velocity, then we see that there is tau eta here. And then we can ask ourselves, what is the scale separation for some typical flow that we can do in the laboratory? And I want to bring this up here because this is something where we can see that on Earth, there is no large scale separation, usually, other than in the highest turbulent flows like the atmosphere. Especially with respect to time, because these things scale differently, right? What I can also show is that the Reynolds number I can rewrite as L over eta to the 4/3, or as T over tau eta squared. So again, two different exponents, as you would expect, and then you see this thing is 1. If L is equals 1, this is 1. If T is equals tau eta, this is where this thing is equals 1, right? And so what that means is we have these time scales. So let me give you a little table. So if I write down air, and a typical length scale, let's say U is 1 meter per second, which is a good number. I can tell you this is what you end up with always. The length scale is about 0.1 meter, which is a typical number that you get. And the time scale of that, of course, is about 0.1 seconds. And then you ask yourself, what are these parameters here? And what you find is you find L over eta is roughly 800. And T over tau eta is roughly 80. So what you immediately see is if I have a cascade process in space, it's fine. You know, 800 is at least, you know, 10 to the 2 or 10 to the 3 almost. While in time, I get at best well, perhaps two decades if I'm lucky, right? And then you can do the same game for water. For water, what do you find for the same parameters? I should write down the Reynolds number for this. The Reynolds number for this is about 7,000. And if you do the same game for water, let me just put the numbers for water. So this is H2O. What I get here 10 to the 5. So you clearly notice that there's more energy in my flow to get 1 meter per second velocity fluctuations. L over eta is about 6,000. This one is about 300. And exactly. What's also important is that we need to see what eta is. So eta for this, for air, is approximately 0.1 millimeter. And eta for the water is 20 microns. And tau eta is 0.1 seconds, is 1.2 milliseconds. So it's 1 millisecond. And tau eta for the, so this is, sorry, this is water. And so tau eta for water is 0.3 milliseconds. And now you can immediately see what makes the life of the experimenter tough, because these things here are just so tiny. And you have to make tracing, velocity, every resolution you have to do at these small scales. Okay, so let me, so we have this cascade. We go from larger to smaller scales. Now, if you want to simulate this whole thing, what you naively argue is, well, you need a number. You need the number of, you know, the spatial resolution. It's just the spatial resolution goes like L over eta cubed, right? Just the volume. And T over tau eta is just our typical time resolution that we need. And if you put this all in, then you see that this thing scales something like R. The naive scaling would be R cubed. It's in reality, when you do all the tricks of the trade, it's a little bit better. But basically, for homogeneous, isotropic, ideal, Fourier space, periodic box simulations, and you do a 4096 cubed simulation, which is using the largest available computers. They're even thinking about larger now. Then what you get is you get typically an R lambda. Now we went to R lambda, which is this square root, you know, remember? R lambda is square root of 15 or E. What you get is you get about 10 to the 3, perhaps, you know, 2 times 10 to the 3, 1 times 10 to the 3. So you get about 1,000. Now this is typically where also the normal experiments are right now. We are typically at R lambda 1,000. These are the normal experiments. Now let me end with a little bit of formulating the questions, and I know that Krisha will have to fill in a little bit more of this. Yes?
1,000 big or moderate or small?
Well, 1,000 is about 7 million.
What?
7 million in real Reynolds number. Let me give you an example to close off, to tell you whether it's small or big.
It's big.
It's big, but not, but when you look at the, when you look at the, look.
The question is whether some things already scale, whether they already universal at this number. Some are.
This is this case, right? So this is this case H2O. And what you find is that the scale separation in time is 300. This is about 1200 R lambda, this example that I gave here. This is big. It's actually big. But still, so far nobody actually has seen any scaling range other than a bump in the second order velocity structure from Lagrangian second order velocity structure function. In space, we see a beautiful scaling law, you know, in second order, it's great, fantastic. But in temporal respects, in the Lagrangian frame where I'm moving with the fluid element, where the sweeping is not important, we still haven't seen an asymptotic, anything that looks like any decade or anything. It's just a bump, a maximum. So which means that we haven't reached the scaling law any yet. And that's why a lot of people are now building bigger, stronger experiments.
Yeah, but do you understand why that is? Why you need such large R lambda? I mean, a priori, I would think I should compare this 10 cubed to something of order 1.
Yeah.
Right? Because it comes out of the flow itself.
Because time scales slower.
There's no reason to think that it has to be very, very large compared to one.
Well, it's because the time scales are so awfully, you know, are so awfully, the scale separation time is so awfully small.
Are they 1 over r, 1 over the square root of r, 1 over 10th root of r?
Unfortunately, sum of most interesting is r Reynolds in the power of 1/3.
Yes.
That's not that fast which saturates with Reynolds number. Right. And in other words, what Rydberg has said over and over, the time, unfortunately, scales like Reynolds square root, which means that it's... In space, we see beautiful scalings. In time,
it's not that good.
Yeah.
No. For example, if you want to ask yourself, there's this problem, I don't have much time, of Richardson dispersion, where you ask yourself, if I take two plops of two balloons, throw them up in the atmosphere, and it's turbulent, how fast do they separate? Then initially, they separate ballistically. So they're like trapped in some kind of vortex structure, and then you can imagine that vortex structure lives for statistically for a certain time, and so the separation goes like, separation scale goes like t squared, right? But if you go further out, then the expectation is that the system forgets about the initial separation completely, so it doesn't know anymore where the particles came from. It's completely stochastic, worse than chaotic, it's absolutely stochastic. And now you say, well, then it goes just like t cubed, so it's faster. But to really see that scaling range, in our experiments where we had our lambda 1000, we definitely couldn't see it. And in the simulations, well, you know, you find a T-cubed law, but not the independence of the initial condition. So I don't know what it means to do that. It's interesting, of course, and seeing all this, but it's still not really fully resolved. And that's why you want to get up the Reynolds number. But let me close with a little remark which connects a little bit to what I started out with, which is this problem of our cloud streets. Right, so here's my cloud street. The typical scale here, the metrologists have to forgive me, let's call this 1 kilometer, okay? And the cloud, let's say, is about a few 500 meters high, you know, here's our cloud, here's another cloud. We have a wind blowing through, we have beautiful order. You can look up often, you see these beautiful cloud streets. We know at a wind speed of 30 meters per second, they turn, they go, there's a codimension 2 point where they go from longitudinal to transverse. Everybody who flies a soaring airplane knows that because they have to be careful once they see these things. They know what they're getting. They know something about the mean wind. And so we know that here's this turbulence in here, right? So here we have a large-scale ordered structure with highly turbulent small scales. And if you put the numbers in, what you find for this R lambda here, R lambda is of the order of 10 to the 4, to 2 times 10 to the 4. So this is the highest Reynolds number one can expect on Earth. A volcanic eruption like Mount St. Helens, when you do the calculation, forget about the dust. So if you ignore the dust and just say this is a jet, you do the calculation, you also get about 10 to the 4. So this means if we want to go higher than 10 to the 4, we have to leave Earth. Or we have to build an experiment with superfluid helium in a huge tank, which people are dreaming about at CERN. They hope to get part of the helium and build a big experiment. But what does the turbulence tell you if you can't measure it? So because the scales will be so tiny that we also have to make measurement technology to even resolve it. But in principle, we can make higher Reynolds number on Earth than are naturally occurring. That works. And so if you put the numbers here in a cloud like this, the typical energy injection scale, the typical L, is about 50 to 100 meters. Okay? So this problem is 1 kilometer, huge. The turbulence length scale where you do this Kolmogorov theory would be about 50 to 100 meters. And the typical Kolmogorov length scale is of order 0.1 millimeters. And the typical time scale is about 0.1 seconds. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is you really have to go down there. And why is this important? Because when you now, we have a perspective in science, if you want to read it, it's just one page, very easy to read. If you now zoom into this thing, then you zoom down, and suddenly you're in the middle of turbulence. And in the middle of turbulence, there's particles. And these particles are inertial. This means these particles have a mass different from the fluid. And it was part of a former program that these particles now behave differently from the fluid because they explore different regions of the fluid preferentially because they're being because of the inertial forces, they leave vortices, for example. They go into stagnation point areas. They can even have a discontinuity in the velocity fields. You know, particle can come here like this, another one come like that. At one point, you have a completely discontinuous velocity field. You also can have this particle field itself is highly compressible. You can, you know, plump a lot of particles together. And why am I saying this? Because if you want to have rain initiation, what you need to know is, or rain initiation or cloud forming, you need different sizes of droplets, otherwise you don't get rain, because only then you have this gravitational instability where the big guys fall faster than the small ones and take everything with them, what's below them, and then you get rain. And so the big issue is, can you come up with a model that is actually at the 1 meter scale and predict from that model what they should put into the global circulation models later on to say where should you expect clouds? Because depending on where the clouds are on the equator, you just have to move them a little bit further north, or you move them a little bit further south, the Earth heats or cools. So what that means is clouds are very important, and we just cannot get away from the Kolmogorov prediction of small 20 micron, 5 micron droplets in a cloud. And so we have a focus week on particles, and Sharon Beck and a lot of people in this room work on particles. And so particles and turbulence is a big issue. Because the question, for example, is if I take a golf ball or a ping pong ball and throw it up, a ping pong perhaps not, but a golf ball or even a boccia ball up in a hurricane, how does it move? The Kolmogorov scale now is smaller than the ball, and there's no formula that describes how this thing is moved. We couldn't even calculate in a turbulent flow what the governing equation are of a large object, either the ball, in a turbulent flow that's bigger than the Kolmogorov size of our flow. And this is part of this project here too, which we are looking at. So let me close in summarizing the list of tables. There's also turbulent Rayleigh-Binard convection, which I don't have time to, and turbulent Taylor-Coet flow, which we will talk about. And so let me just summarize so that what we want to study is turbulence and coherent structures. We want to study what happens if you have 2D turbulence, where you have an inverse cascade, so you go from small to large instead of from large to small. And the question is what happens in between. This is something Krishna is very interested in. We want to study boundary layers, and Nigel will tell us about this today. Then we want to study the turbulent Rayleigh-Binard convection, where a lot of the interesting physics is just happening in the boundary layer, but it has huge consequences for the whole big container that's turbulently convecting. We would like to figure out how this coupling happens. How do you do actually an elimination of, you know, the fluctuating degrees of freedom here, and then couple it to some larger structures that form some type of patterns or ordered coherent structures. We want to look at tracer and particle dynamics. That one I can't read. Who remembers? We also want to look at quantum turbulence, which is a completely new problem, because there is no dissipation at the small scales, and all the energy is dissipated somehow. I don't think people really know where how it gets out of the system, and this will be one of the topics here at this conference, probably today or tomorrow. The question is, you know, how is the cascade where we find the same 5/3 scaling, the same scaling of the velocity fluctuations, how is it scaling out? Dan Lathrop is here. Where's Dan? He has left. Okay. And so this is what we want to do. So in other words, what's happening around the world is a large number of new facilities. So we have a big facility in Göttingen where we can generate very high Reynolds and Rayleigh numbers. There's a new facility in 20 where there's a huge Taylor-Coet experiment. There's another one in Maryland. There is a huge initiative in Grenoble on helium, close with helium. We hear about this, I think, today also. And very high Reynolds number, turbulent jets in helium, low temperature helium gas. I just heard there's a big, huge rotating tank just being renovated in France, also in Grenoble, where they study rotating, you know, turbulence in presence of rotation with inertial waves and everything that happens in the ocean. So why is this all happening? Well, the reason is quite simple. We're making progress theoretically. We are making progress, huge progress experimentally with the measurement techniques, which we couldn't have before. And all this is possible because we have big computers now to analyze all this huge amount of data and try to make sense of it. So in other words, there's a renaissance. In the last 10 years, there has been a renaissance in turbulence, I would call it. We are revisiting things that people worried about in the 1930s, 1950s, continuously, even before that. And the big progress is we can do numerical simulations, so we can actually check numerics versus experiment very carefully. We can build huge experiments that actually bring us new data, so we can go out there in regimes where numerics can't go. And we can start to look at, you know, anisotropic flows. We start to look at particles in turbulence. We try to make contact to protoplanetary disk formation, for example, where the same effect as in clouds is at work. And so there's a large scale of things that are now possible, and that's, I think that's why the age, David, is a little younger than it was last time. Thank you.
Questions?
Well,
you know, back to whether, you know, our lambda 1000 is big or small number. You somehow said that it's not big enough because there's a discrepancy between your Lagrangian and, or, you know, temporal and spatial.
So it's not a discrepancy. I mean, it's just that the scaling range and the Lagrangian range is much smaller.
But it basically strikes me as not a matter of going to a larger Reynolds number, but a matter of understanding of why you get a clean scaling in space.
This and would be very, time, very right? Nice.
Yes, and you can do it, as you say, with the present range of simulation.
And this is exactly what we are doing. We are actually now comparing very carefully, for example, with the Tetrad model or other models. We have now data that we can compare very, very carefully with smaller amounts of data. So the two actually overlap beautifully, and we just keep up on this idea of going to high posture and larger flows. And of course, experimentally, you know, I actually personally would like to see Richardson dispersion in my wind tunnel. That's why I built it. That's the only reason, so to speak. I built this thing because I would like to know whether I find a scaling range. And from everything we've measured and from all those numerics and from everything, it looks like if we add another decade to our lambda, it should be there.
But you need a bigger tunnel.
No, it's there already. It just takes a while to get it to the point where it actually produces data that, you know, physicists would argue are real and not just some garbage. And so we're working on that, but this is, because you have to do particle tracking, I forgot to say, if you do particle tracking, of course, all these things work very well when we have no mean flow. As soon as you have a fast scale mean flow, you have to move with the flow, which causes experimentalists to enormous headaches. For example, the wind tunnel, we actually have to drive with the wind, otherwise we will not be able to do it. And that alone is an engineering problem that, you know, you cannot publish the engineering, but it takes years just to build a sled that doesn't vibrate, that moves through the wind at 5 meters per second, and then you can do particle tracking at about 10,000, 20,000 pitches per second. So this is what we have to do. And then we have to put the particles in, they shouldn't be inertial, right? So that the theory is convinced we are doing something real, we're going to work on inertial particles. But I agree with Boris 100%. I think the time is right to really run the simulations against the experiment and against the theory in an upfront manner at low Reynolds number. Low by roll, I mean these high ones, which we can reach, but I think there can be huge amount of stuff can be learned just by doing exactly that. And so we're here because that's what we want to do, right? Because otherwise you should have it when they're higher flows. We can pull quite. Thank you.